appropriate rulings, whether it be an overturning of Love versus Dallas, or whether it be more specific in your opinion, we urge this court to do so. And further, we do urge this court to at least send a strong signal to the trial court that we do not want to get caught in the same squeeze that we got caught in the last time around. And we firmly believe that if we can come together with the state's experts and our experts in a non-liability fight where you're not fighting over is a bill constitutional or not, and pool the resources to come up with a plan that makes sense in a court setting, that the district court, through the appropriate process of a master or otherwise, is the appropriate way to do that. We urge that we have that process started forthwith so we don't run into the bind that we ran into last time around.
Counsel, I have your brief in front of me in which you point out that as one of the petitioners, your position is somewhat different. Let me ask you the same question. Is there any amount of money which your independent research has shown would have cured the problem?
Well, and the answer to it, Your Honor, is you can reach 100% of equity at $179 billion. And we realize that, spending that sum of money to provide equity is not an efficient use of state dollars, and you can provide equity by a whole lot less if you make other changes. Some of which no one, not even the districts that are concerned about consolidation, oppose, such as why does Senate Bill 1 continue to allow tax havens to exist? Why under Senate Bill 1 do we continue to have school districts existing in the state that have 2, 3, and 4 students? Why under Senate Bill 1 do we continue to send $300 per student to those 124 districts that I told you about earlier that the state says are so wealthy that we're going to exclude from the system altogether, yet the state under Senate Bill 1 will send $40 or $50 billion a year of state revenue to those very districts?
You have both previously and today referred to political hot potatoes and the legislature, but you don't define them. I would like to ask you a question. It used to be in Texas that for every 100 school employees, 67 were teachers. We now have a situation where substantially less than 50% of school employees are teachers. We have many more administrators. Is that one of the problems?
If I step back and run the risk of having some of my clients be upset at me, yes. Every study that has been done shows that the current system is not efficient, that we have an awful lot of school districts, rich and poor alike, with very, very small numbers of students who, no matter how much money you spend on them, it's hard to imagine that they can get a good comprehensive education. And that has been pointed out since the Conley Commission in the 60s, since the Gilmer Aiken studies in the 40s, and that is a reality. Now, that goes back to the hard choices the state has to make. We're not here saying to the state or to the legislature or to this court that you have to do away with those districts. If the state wants to allow that kind of district and that kind of situation to continue, more power to it. We just don't want the poor students in the state and the poor school districts to be penalized because the state makes another choice. If they want to make that choice, that's fine. We just don't want for them to take it out of our pockets when they make that choice.
But it's costing us on the far end when we have all these 35,000 people in the penitentiary at $20,000 a year, doesn't it? I mean,
sure,
we're picking up the tab somewhere.
Sure.
The question is whether we're going to pick it up in kindergarten or we're going to pick it up in the penitentiary.
It's a question.
We don't have enough penitentiaries to house all the people now. The judges are sending.
Pay me now.
Somewhere
or pay me
we've got to stop it.
That's right.
And how many times do we have to let the legislature go in? Five members of this court are former members of the legislature. We know what goes on over there.
But
some members of this court think they're still in the legislature.
In conclusion, I know I'm exhausting my time, and I apologize.
Yeah, your time is really pretty.
The very districts the state is excluding, these 124 districts, if they were to tax at the target tax rate of $1.18 that the state projects everybody else to tax, the evidence is undisputed from the state's own records that there'd be an additional $500 million a year for education. The state's own records show that they estimate the cost of facilities, which Senate Bill 1 does nothing on, but promised to study, which they've been studied ad infinitum.
Mr. Gray, your time has long expired. I don't know if you need any time for Mr. Richards or not.
Thank you.
I think he was in response to a question, but we have had over an hour of this.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Had close to an hour of this argument. In light of the fact that we've extended time, the court will allot an extra 15 minutes to the state, and we'll also take a very brief recess of less than 10 minutes at this time so that we can come back and give our full attention to the state's argument and to the rebuttal argument for the appellant. Thank you. Be seated. The court is ready to hear oral argument from appellees.
May it please the court, Ms. Tony Hunter and Mr. Kevin O'Hanlon will present arguments for appellees. Ms. Hunter, you're open.
Please, the court. This case is here in a unique posture. The prevailing party in the district court has brought this direct appeal, complaining of not getting an injunction while they won on the constitutional issues. And I think the question is squarely in front of the court as to whether or not they have invoked direct appeal jurisdiction. The injunction was denied for public policy reasons. There is, of course, the constitutional issue in the case. And we think that the Gardner case and the Percolator case indicate that if the injunction was denied on other grounds, that perhaps direct appeal jurisdiction is not here.
Well, in that regard, Ms. Hunter, referring you to your response to the jurisdictional point that you filed on October the 19th, at that time the state said that the issues presented by this litigation will not be finally decided until decided by this court, and that a delay would serve no one, and that the state's position was that we should invoke our jurisdiction the sooner the better for everyone involved. Is that still the state's position?
That is the state's position, Your Honor, that there is no point in delaying a decision in this case for anyone. We did point out in that jurisdictional statement that even when you get over the first question of whether jurisdiction is invoked, there is a limitation on the jurisdiction in terms of legal as opposed to fact question. And we had some concern that there were fact questions in this case.
You explained in your response how those could be dealt with.
Yes, Your Honor.
And your position remains that if without doing violence to basic legal principles, we can make clear whether Senate Bill 1 satisfies this court's prior opinion. We ought to do that rather than ducking or dodging that issue and piecemealing this whole matter.
Well, Your Honor, we think that there are things that the court can do under its jurisdiction and things that they can't do. And I think that you clearly can deny the injunction that the plaintiffs are seeking here, and that would be a matter of legal issue. We think that you can grant our cross appeal in which we argue that the district court acted prematurely in declaring Senate Bill 1 unconstitutional. That's a question that's a legal question. We don't think that you can grant the plaintiff's injunction without making a determination that Senate Bill 1 is unconstitutional. You might be able to do that on surely legal grounds. If the court's willing to announce today that it offends the Constitution if 5% of the students are admitted from the equalization, then I think on a legal basis you might be able to go ahead and say Senate Bill 1 is unconstitutional. If you're willing to say that a financing plan that does not cap the system offends the Constitution, then I believe you could go ahead and find Senate Bill 1 unconstitutional. If you're willing to say today that the only kind of plan that satisfies efficiency is a plan that consolidates school districts or consolidates tax bases, then I believe you can go ahead and find Senate Bill 1 unconstitutional. But I believe if you enter into the debate as to whether or not Senate Bill 1 will work or not work, then you are in an issue of fact. And I think we have argued in our cross-appeal that in fact, wasn't even right for the district court to determine, because the court held hearings in July of 1990, months before Senate Bill 1 would become effective. So that the hearing became one on projections, expert opinions, and expert guesses. we feel that that doesn't give a factual basis to determining whether the bill will work or not, that that forced the court into the situation of substituting its presumptions, its assumptions for those of the legislature, and that that is not a judicial function. It's our opinion that the district court should have waited and given Senate Bill 1 an opportunity to work. Senate Bill 1, any financing plan, as the court is well aware, is a difficult animal to create and a difficult animal to make equal and fiscally neutral. Senate Bill 1 or any plan could satisfy the plaintiffs and the plaintiffs' intervenors' position if it in fact capped the tax rate. For example, Senate Bill 1 in the 94-95 school year projects equalization up to $1.18. That is not, it's not frozen at $1.18, but the projections that we presented at trial were at $1.18. And Senate Bill, if we were to satisfy the plaintiffs and plaintiffs' intervenors' idea of equity or neutrality, the state could say that is it. That's the cap. No one else can tax beyond $1.18. The state will equalize up to that amount. For the 5% of districts that are out of the 95%, the state could say you may only spend this certain amount of dollars, whatever that turned out to be, $5,000, $4,700, whatever the per pupil expenditure was going to be under the $1.18, that's all you can spend. That would satisfy the complaints that plaintiffs and plaintiff intervenors bring to the court. The legislature chose not to do that because the legislature felt that that kind of frozen system, that rigidity, wasn't what was good for education in Texas. So Senate Bill 1 adds additional dollars to the finance program, adds additional dollars to education, and almost step by step takes the standards that this court enunciated in Act 1 and puts them into statute and makes those the standards that the actions that that future members of the LEB and the Foundation School Budget Fund Committee and the LBB will have to live up to as they go through the steps in Senate Bill 1 to adopt the various formulas that will yield the funding. Senate Bill 1 puts into place a panel of independent experts that will advise the LEB and the LBB about what is fiscally neutral. They will look at several measures of fiscal neutrality. They've already begun to meet to do that, and determine whether or not Senate Bill 1 is in fact closing that gap. What Senate Bill 1 attempts to do is by putting more money into Tier 1 and Tier 2, capture more of what traditionally has been Tier 3 and make Tier 3 almost non-existent. And in a series of exhibits called J1, the state presented their projections of what would happen under Senate Bill 1. And we clearly presented there that if districts taxed over $1.18, it would call for adjustment because the system would then become, again, unequal. And what the district court has to do to find Senate Bill 1 unconstitutional is project that when that point in time comes, future legislatures will not adjust. Future legislatures will allow the plan to become unequal again. And we think that that was an unfair thing for the district court to do and inappropriate to do without any particular evidence to base that on.
The state's position is that what the district court should have done is to wait until a child who entered the first grade when this lawsuit was filed graduated from high school and then evaluated whether the system had in fact worked when the Senate Bill 1 is fully implemented.
I think that overstates the case, Your Honor. I think that what you have is a bill that becomes operational on September 1, 1990, which is posited very clearly against the standards that this court set. I think the day was changed in Texas when you defined efficiency. And the day was changed when you said what it was that the legislature had to accomplish. And that standard is there, and it's not going to go away. I think you have a legislative session coming up. You can look at the evidence. It's beginning to come in right now in terms of how Senate Bill 1 is being operationalized. When the district court acted, there was no evidence. There was no effective act at that point. I think the evidence will be in much sooner than when that person graduates from high school to determine whether or not Senate Bill 1 has in fact effectuated equality in the system.
But the bill won't be fully implemented until that person has graduated from high school.
I'm sorry, I'm perhaps losing the dates. 1994, 1995 is when the projection says we should be able to see a closing of the gap in Tier 3 so that you don't have the unequal funding. But all through the process, you're going to have adjustments. All through the process, you're going to have the LEB and the LBB setting aside funds to cover the anticipated expenditures in the next school year.
Are you going to have adjustments, or are you going to give the legislature an opportunity to make adjustments in the future? There's nothing automatic about Senate Bill 1.
No, Your Honor. The Senate Bill 1 doesn't appropriate money. It requires...
Well, don't you kind of meet yourself coming around the corner? You're arguing on the one hand that the trial court couldn't project the effect of this in the out years because he didn't know how it was going to work and what the legislature was going to do. And on the other hand, you're saying, but you've got to assume the legislature's going to do what these projections show. I just don't think you can have it both ways.
I think you can have some factual data before you make a decision. I think you can have the beginning of the operation of Senate Bill 1. Already,
no one can ever challenge a plan as to constitutionality until after it's already visited its unconstitutional virus upon the people for whom it was designed to serve. Is that it?
No, Your Honor. I believe that the court, by entertaining the original suit and by finding the system unconstitutional, has a much closer hold on what the legislature does right now with school financing than that scenario would indicate. I think it would be clearly within this court's power and the district court's power to say what the expectation is by the end of the school year. The district court could have, and I think this court probably could today, say these promises have been made in Senate Bill 1. These are the outcomes that these promises should yield for the students in Texas. We're going to wait and see for a year. If those outcomes aren't coming, then we're going to do something about it. I don't think we're in a position where the judiciary is helpless to correct the legislative failures. All we're saying is that I think it's fair to the legislature to wait until the bill begins to be implemented and until you can really judge it on facts and not just on worst-case scenarios.
Ms. Hunter, that's what state government has been doing in Texas about public school education since 1966 when the Copsey Committee report was filed. A committee was appointed in 1963 by Governor Connally, and it reported in 1966. And ever since then, we've been saying, just wait, we're going to get to it, we're going to get to it. And we haven't.
And I think that...
How much longer, how many more generations have to wait to do what the Constitution of Texas has said since 1876 they're entitled to expect?
Your Honor, I don't believe any generation should wait. I believe that the court has the tools in front of it to judge Senate Bill 1, to bring Senate Bill 1 back before whatever proper body would be the district court more likely, and say it isn't working. All we're saying is it should have the opportunity to get started before it's declared unconstitutional.
Counsel, does the state deny that the 95-95, if I may refer to that line in the statute, excludes significant amount of revenue from the financing system?
No, Your Honor.
How can a system which excludes almost as much revenue as the state just put into it be efficient? It seems to me, why isn't that just sort of like leaving the back door of your house open and claiming that you've got an efficient heating system? It seems that a lot of revenue is getting away.
Your Honor, this court and the district court acknowledged that some line drawing had to occur, that 100% equity was a goal that the legislature at this point couldn't afford. Where that line is drawn, I believe, is a legislative function. The legislature chose the 95% line. It was supported in the legislative process by many of the experts who testified during that process and at the trial court.
But that assumes maintaining the present structure.
Yes, Your Honor.
This is not a question of whether it should be 95-95 or 96-94 or some other line drawing adjustments, but the fact that the system is devised in such a way that revenue, which reasonably ought to be available to the system, is not. How can that be efficient?
I guess that is part of what you buy into when you have a combination state tax aid and local district plan.
Not a necessary result.
And it occurs that it's been our tradition anyway to allow school districts to spend as much as they deem necessary in their pursuit of education within that district. How much the state can afford to bring others up to that is the issue, and that is a tough one to solve.
If the districts are left in place and the tax bases are not otherwise consolidated, then
and we're left with an equalization plan, you're basically saying there's going to be some inefficiency built into that plan.
The definition of the equalization plan is that the state is going to keep trying to catch up, I guess, to what the school districts who have the ability to spend can do.
You heard Mr. Gray's quotation of the veto message of one of the bills passed by the legislature. Does the state agree that the final Senate Bill 1 was not so much different from the one then vetoed by the governor?
It was not considerably different, Your Honor. It did, and it will, and has already begun to put more money into the system than was projected in the one vetoed by the governor, and the one that was projected even in the fiscal note for Senate Bill 1.
Why shouldn't the court give great weight to the determination of the executive branch that that legislation did not meet the constitutional requirements?
Your Honor, I think that what is said politically in one arena and what becomes evidentiary in another arena, it's been my experience, there's some gap there.
Nobody, there wasn't a Bible in the room.
Well, Your Honor, I'd rather not comment whether a Bible makes a difference.
As far as the amount of additional money that was added by the bill, is it undisputed that it was not enough to cover inflation for the period?
No, Your Honor, that is disputed in terms of how the mechanism is going to work. Already, more money has been set aside for the 92-93 school year than the district court found would be set aside for the entire period of implementation that it looked at.
That was the district court's determination, was that there was not enough money added to cover inflation.
Yes, Your Honor, he did find it.
Was it undisputed that the basic foundation program allotment under the bill was not up to the level that the state's own experts determined to be adequate?
That was disputed, and we believe that Senate Bill 1 has put the mechanism in place to keep adjusting the allotment for education so that it will better reflect what the cost of the standards are. It requires that it does.
But at present, for the present school year, the state does not even meet the level of adequacy that it set for itself, does it? Is that the determination of the district
That
court?
Was the determination of the district
and
court.
And is it undisputed
it
for
is,
this year?
It is undisputed for this year. It is disputed that will
and since
stay the same.
And then the future, though, depends on what the legislature voluntarily chooses to do, not upon any mechanism that's automatically built into Senate Bill 1. Isn't that correct?
That's correct.
The dispute comes on essentially the good faith of the legislature and the will of the people
correct.
To see that sufficient monies are appropriated.
That's correct, Your Honor. But within the framework that this issue is in front of the court, that the district court is continuing jurisdiction and that there is somebody there is a body of government out there that will rate and grade what does occur.
So the state advocates essentially leaving this case open in perpetuity for the district court to monitor the legislature's conduct in accordance with our Edgewood 1 opinion.
I would hope not in perpetuity. I think there's no getting away from the fact that the case is open at this point, that the district court is going to come back under any scenario and look at either if its order stands, then it'll look at what was produced in this legislative session and gauge whether that's constitutional or not. If you send it back and say no, you acted too soon, then there'll be a wait-and-see period of time, and the court will look at it again. I think it's inevitable that we're looking at least one other trial and presentation to a district court on whether the financing system is working.
Are
hopefully
we in danger
won't be
of breaking New Jersey's record?
No, we hope to not do that.
Scenario.
Ms. Hunter, last year this court said that our system was not constitutional. We didn't say anything about the amount of money that the legislature was appropriating. Now, as I hear what you're saying about Senate Bill 1, we did, the legislature did, appropriate considerably more money to put into the system. But would you detail for us the system changes that Senate Bill 1 provides for us?
Okay, Your Honor. System-wide, what Senate Bill 1 does is empower the LEB and the Foundation School Budget Committee and the LBB to early on make by rule certain determinations of what the formulas are going to be for determining what dollars go into education, and to actually have those monies reserved so that they are taken out of what is available to appropriate to other agencies in Texas. What it does is put in place the standards announced by this court as the standards against which the operation of the system will be judged. It puts in place a panel of experts and a committee structure that will look at whether or not the system is fiscally neutral and requires them to make some adjustment when they find that the system is not neutral. It has done some other small things in terms of raising tax rate, what will be captured in Tier 1 and Tier 2.
You used the word requires a minute ago. Requires, you mean it requires that some reports be made. It does not require that the legislation be amended.
I believe it's stronger than that. I mean, it sets out that the system shall be fiscally neutral. It sets in place the studies, and it sets in place how the studies will be reported to the LEB and the LBB and the Foundation School Budget Committee. But they have to live up.
Studies, and this was the response to change the system. It made some additional studies or provided for additional studies.
Your Honor, it approached the change in the system by believing that what was better was to put in money to try to capture what has been spent in Tier 3 traditionally, and then to require by study that we find out what is necessary for an adequate education, what's necessary for necessary facilities, and that those things be realistically defined.
Well, does that contemplate additional legislation then?
It contemplates, I believe, no.
In order to have an efficient system, that they have to have additional legislation based on the studies that are to be made?
It contemplates having additional decisions made. I don't think there's a need for necessarily additional legislation. If, in fact, the legislature is willing to continue to appropriate the money to catch Tier 3, then there would be no need probably for additional legislation. If you get to a point in time where the legislature can't appropriate any more money or won't appropriate any more money, but still must meet the fiscally neutral standard, then it's possible that there should be another bit of legislation, a cap or
and
something of that sort.
And a fiscally neutral standard would provide for an efficient system.
That's what
the state's position.
Yes, Your Honor.
So if we do in fact have too many administrators, we don't have any system that's going to eliminate some of those.
Your Honor, in fact, the bill puts in place a requirement that the comptroller go out and look at the efficiency of school districts and make some determinations as to whether or not they are operating in an efficient manner. And that's an operational efficiency as well as a financial efficiency. So to that extent, I think
does the comptroller have any power or merely the obligation to make a report?
An obligation to make a report, Your Honor.
And in that regard, there's been some demand here this morning for greater specificity, but our order last year said change the system, make it efficient, and do it immediately in those terms. And if I understand what you're saying, the reaction of the state was to provide less money for this school year than it itself deemed to be adequate, to hire some consultants, and to set up a study committee. Is that the essence of it? I mean, it sounds to me, we also said we don't want a Band-Aid on the system, and it sounds to me like the state is saying that the best it's good for is an 8th bandage.
I don't believe that's exactly what happened, Your Honor. I think, first of all, the court clearly said that the manner in which efficiency was met was the responsibility of the legislature, and recognized that it was a complex process and that it would take time. It wasn't going to happen immediately. I think Senate Bill 1 is far more than a Band-Aid on the system. If you can look just at what the district court looked at in terms of, the district court reviewed all the other plans that were in front of the legislature and was unable to make a finding of fact on any of them as being a more constitutional plan, a more equitable plan.
Given the political and constraints and the desire of the parties, I mean, you really didn't explore some of the alternatives because you discarded them as being either politically unfeasible or not quite the part of
them. Or against offensive to the Constitution on other grounds.
Yes.
Which is, to some extent, I guess, the same dynamic that the legislature has to deal with. It's that same give and take in terms of what the people will want in Texas, that the legislature has to deal with. So that, I think, is not too far removed of a context.
And with reference to all these studies, unless the wealthy school districts are tied so that they're interfaced with the poorer school districts, won't there always be an incentive for those in the wealthier districts to let the statewide funding level drop while locally they can vote as much extra money as they want to ensure that their children get a privileged and special class education?
I think that they're driving the system in another way under Senate Bill 1 because fiscal neutrality is the measure that Senate Bill 1 adopts. As they go out and spend more, that makes the gap that will show up in the standard higher, and Senate Bill 1 is going to have to, the legislature under Senate Bill 1 is going to have to adjust. So their
expenditures. And they've set themselves some precatory language and a moral obligation, but they don't have to. I mean, the introductory language to the whole education code right now says that every student in Texas will have equal access to education, will have an equal opportunity, essentially equal financing. That was adopted in House Bill 72. And then it proceeds to set up a system that doesn't do that. And what's different about these goals in Senate Bill 1 than the goals that were set forth in the introductory paragraph to House Bill 72?
Well, I believe what's different is that we're going to have a definition of fiscal neutrality. That process has begun. No one measure was adopted for fiscal neutrality by the legislature because of a variety of disagreements as to what might be good and probably a lack of time to really consider those. Once the panel of experts is in place and they have begun meeting, they will suggest measures to look at fiscal neutrality. Once those measures, either a singular measure or several measures, are adopted to look at the plan, they will be in place and they will generate a picture of neutrality in Texas.
Well, if those studies show that you're going to have to spend $100 million to accomplish Goal A, that group doesn't have the power to appropriate that money. They've still got to go back to the legislature, don't they?
Yes, Your Honor.
So all they can do is issue a report and say, we think that if you would do this, if you'd appropriate this $100 million, it would get us closer to this goal. But that's all they can do. And isn't that the reason the trial court says it's largely illusory?
Well, what the trial court says, I believe, is that what Senate Bill 1 does is write history into law. And to some extent, that's a true statement, but it's a statement which misses some of the points of history. Some of what occurred historically has been good. Each time that there has been an infusion of dollars into the system, it has brought about greater equality. Senate Bill 1 continues that good part of history. What it tries to do is put a stop to the part of history where there isn't, as you've indicated, the correction.
Well, as a matter of fact, it's true. How did we ever get this thing out of whack if each time we put a patch on it, we got us closer to equality? How did we get to a 700-to-1 ratio?
Because we had a system, you know, that continued to grow, that continued to have reach out further and spend more money on education. If we capped the system, we have equality in an easy way. We could say, this is it. This state of Texas is going to spend $5,000 across the board per student to educate them. That would be an equal system. That would be an easy answer.
When you said earlier that each time the state appropriates more money or dedicates more money to education, we close the gap, that's just not historically true. History tells us just the opposite, doesn't it?
I believe it tells you that the gap is closed and then it reopens as the richer school districts go out and appropriate.
The gap was not 700-to-1 when Gilmer Aiken was passed in 1949. What we found that it was in 1989.
That's correct.
Now that gap didn't come from whatever it was when Gilmer Aiken went into effect in 1949. 40 years later to 700-to-1 by being reduced, did it?
No, it got that way by district spending more money on education, which I think the legislature is accepting as a healthy approach.
And by the legislature spending more money on education, too, but directing it in such a way that rather than closing the disparity, it elongated it. Is that not historically correct?
I'm not sure that it is. That the legislature appropriated money in a way that caused the gap to get bigger. I think that that was a function of what school districts did in spending
because
money
of the formulas that were set up by the legislature and are set forth by the TEA under the direction of the legislature when it gave them rulemaking authority.
I think we have a difference of opinion as to the motive behind those formulas. I think those
I'm not talking about motive. I'm talking about effect. I grant everyone the purest of motives, the noblest of motives.
I think that there are many things in the school financing system that the legislature can't control.
Cannot control.
Unless they're going to do something that we maintain probably is not appropriate under the Constitution. They can't control what the wealth of a property district is. They can't control the oil price.
Well,
they can't.
The 700-to-1 that Justice Smalley referred to, it has nothing to do with spending. That's the wealth that's within
right,
the district.
That's a wealth ratio.
And the legislature can consolidate these districts. In fact, we've gone from 7,000 districts to 1,000 districts since Gilmer Aiken.
Yes, we could do that. And that was an option that was looked at in the legislative process and rejected because nobody favored it.
The legislature can't do anything about how valuable the market wants to make a particular piece of property, but they can do a lot about what district that piece of property
that's
is
correct.
Laying around.
So if you made the school district countywide for taxing purposes in Bexar County, you could help solve some Edgewood's problem, couldn't you? The legislature just get around to do it.
Yes, I think you would make it the disparity. You could cure the disparity, which is the Uribe Luna plan. The questions that raises, though, are they were never answered in the legislative process. They were never answered at the district court. In our brief, we discussed some of those questions. And I guess you really raised the question of whether that, in fact, becomes, if the state's going to set the tax rate that each of those counties then could tax at, whether that becomes an ad valorem state property tax also, and is prohibited by the Constitution. If you consolidate countywide, period.
Let me understand what you mean by an ad valorem state property tax. I thought all taxes were state taxes. Are you saying that a tax imposed by an independent school district is not a state tax?
It's a state tax in terms of the school district being an agency of the state. It's probably not a state tax as prohibited by Article 8, Section 3E, which prohibits the state property tax. What I'm saying is that if you consolidated county-wide tax basis and then mandated that they could only spend 80 cents or a dollar, which is what Uribe Luna does, then I think you're very close to actually having a statewide property tax. You may have divided it out and said it's in certain compartments, certain county compartments, but I'm not sure what the differences are between the state just saying the property tax for education is going to be X amount of dollars and collected statewide, or empower the counties to collect it on behalf of the state. There is that tension, if you will, or legal fiction in terms of the district being a state, an arm of the state, but yet having in trust for the people in the local districts the money and the property that they collect pursuant to educational purposes that the Love case deals with.
Do you think it's necessary to overrule Love for us to get to that point?
Do I think it's necessary for you to overrule? Yes, probably.
Ms. Hunter, are you sharing time with...
Yes, I'm sharing time with Mr. O'Hanlon, who will talk to you more about how the Senate Bill 1 works in detail.
Are there any further questions? Thank you, Tim.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be back to rediscuss Senate Bill 1, the legislative governmental response to this court's Edgewood opinion as of October 89. The Edgewood opinion is very closely mirrored in Senate Bill 1. We put it side by side in
in the appendix to the brief that kind of demonstrates that the legislature attempted to respond to the most important provisions in this Supreme Court's opinion. Unanswered questions remain.
Would you detail for us, Mr. O'Hanlon, the system changes that are provided for in Senate Bill 1?
Yes, sir. Before you, I think I gave to the clerk this morning, and there is a... Put it up on the overhead. What Senate Bill 1 did unique in the among the 50 states in the United States of America is attempt to get away from a politically based school finance system and an attempt uniquely, again, to create a research-based school finance system. The question about whether or not the issues must come back ultimately to the political process is partially true and partially not true. There is a wide misperception. The trial court significantly misperceived the role and scope of authority of both the Legislative Education Board, the Legislative Budget Board, and the Foundation School Fund Budget Committee. The studies in the first column on the left are the studies commanded by statute to be made by the Legislative Budget Board and Legislative Education Board that attempt to define from a research basis the elements which comprise the school finance system. Recalling, if you will, that both the trial court and this court endorsed a more flexible concept than simply a per capita allocation of revenues and resources for the students in the state. I.e., they endorsed the notion, both the trial court and this court, have endorsed the notion of weighted pupils and a dispersion of funds based on need rather than on a per capita basis. Senate Bill 1 has delegated to the research process the function of defining operationally on a biennial basis the cost of providing education. Mr. Gray made reference to Mr. Buck's testimony with respect to 16.202B of the Education Code. What Mr. Gray was correct in as far as he went. What Mr. Gray did not tell you is that 16.202B governs allocation of funding for the first tier of the program. 16.002 defines that Senate Bill 1 in the school finance system as a two-tiered school finance system. The function of that, and that is kind of dictated in the second, and there's a little kind of shaded box right here, that defines the first tier. Senate Bill 1 attempts to provide, and the definition occurs in three places, through the operation of Tier 1 for a set 70-cent tax rate in this state, the cost, all the cost, of providing a basic education that meets all statutory and regulatory requirements in the state.
But not facilities costs. Now, we're not talking about facilities in any part of this, are we?
We are talking about facilities. Facilities has been operationally defined and relegated to Tier 2 of the school finance system.
Okay.
If you look at this second part right here, there are two options. The legislature left itself two options for the provision of facilities, and the reason they did it is fairly obvious. Texas simply does not have and has not been able to garner, since this court's opinion, sufficient data with respect to facilities needs in this state. The legislature in Senate Bill 11, which was the Appropriation Act that accompanied Senate Bill 1, appropriated $5 million to fund a facility study that was dictated by 16.401 of the Education Code to determine the facilities needs in this state.
$500 million or
$5 million to do the study. That study is going forward. That the preliminary results will be presented to the legislature in January. The process of the study will take until August of this year, and that's simply as fast as it can be done. We are literally going to walk through, measure, and survey every school building in this state to determine both the quantity, size, measurements, dimensions, and to determine the qualitative aspects of it for purposes of designing a facility study. That facility study is designed and sent to...
Is there any question that the facilities are falling apart and studies after studies after studies have shown that?
The facility, there are some facilities that have done that. There has been no systematic study in this state, Your Honor, that has attempted to look at facilities in terms of needs assessment, growth, and their relationship to the particular wealth of the district. There's certainly anecdotal testimony with respect to, and there was some in the first record in this case, but there are also, there is a significant number of poor districts in the state that have pursued it and have good facilities. You also have the situation in which, and we're attempting to define that, define for the first time, the practice of the districts, which is to whether or not they actually fund facilities from maintenance and operation expenses that have been withheld or budgeted for, or through the bonded indebtedness route. And we're trying to define the pervasiveness of that practice. Until you find that out, you simply cannot design a facilities component that is going to be fair in terms of allocating to those that have already made the sacrifice how to help cover their bonded indebtedness versus those that haven't had the money versus a direct grant or expenditure to help them out. You have to find out where you are. Now, in the event that a separate facility